babies. I'm Steve Hewitt, and you're listening to Freaky Trigger and the Lollards of Pop. It's slightly afternoon on Sunday the 4th of March, and we're starting the broadcast day here on Resonance FM 104.4. Today we're broadcasting live and direct from Tin Pan Alley, surrounded by tunesmiths and lyricists all waiting for their big break, and serving rather good cups of coffee in the meantime. What's to come? Well, we have Moida. Moida, I tell you. And in unusual places at that.
It's not a laughing matter.
We delve into prehistory, times BG before Gambaccini, when the charts were but a twinkle in Al Martino's eye. And to calm us down, we'll be hearing all about the stress-relieving properties of all the extreme violence inherent in the innocuous arts of cookery. On top of all that, our two favourite inebriates, Dr. Pub and Tanya Hedden, will be dropping in too. For those innocents out there, Tanya is a squatter on freakytrigger.co.uk who fizzes bile over all forms of music. But who will feel her acid tongue today? We'll be hearing music from The Great Caruso, Magnetic Fields, Marky Smith and His The Fools, and Free Design, as well as revealing this week's number one on the illegal download chart. Your lollards today are Starry Sarah Clark.
Hello.
Sparky Mark Sinker.
Hello.
And newbie Rob Brennan.
Hello.
First, though, what has gone before? Nonsense, when all is said and done, is still nonsense. But the study of nonsense, that is science. Freaky Trigger, the internet's last remaining sane collective, drops science so you can pick it back up again. This week on Freaky Trigger, there's been follow-up from last week's show, where Maglis blithely claimed that comic strips featuring celebrities no longer existed, and Alan, another of our contributors, pointed us to the weird world of It's Hot magazine, where you can find pint-sized rapper Lil Chris popping up in Casualty, the long-running Saturday Night Which One Will Die medical drama, for reasons that are never even vaguely explained. We also saw the start of Eurovision Fever, with the discovery that this year's Swiss entry is called Vampires Are Alive by DJ Bobo, which has a corking video. But as we found out at Poptimism on Friday night, doesn't really have much going for it on its own without the video there. There's also controversy over the Israeli entry, which some are claiming to be too political. Here's a sample of some of the lyrics of the song. The world is full of terror. If someone makes an error, he's going to blow us to biddy biddy kingdom come.
Biddy biddy.
Biddy biddy.
Biddy biddy.
So, panel. With Eurovision fever starting to fill the air, although it's still a good 10 weeks to the actual programme itself, what do we think about Eurovision? Sarah?
First of all, I'd like to interject Lil Chris. He no rapper. He no rap. He is a rockster.
I suppose.
That's what we call the tiny rockers.
Rocksters. He has big trousers.
Does he?
I think so. Oh. Maybe it's just because he's short. Maybe they look big.
You don't really.
Okay.
Have young people's trousers. But no, I'm excited about Eurovision, especially the Israeli entry, which I heard this morning. You've already done some lyrics, but my favourite one is, I want to see the flowers bloom, not to go kaboom. That's the best one. They also do a bit in French, which of course I don't understand, and then some other languages.
I'm pretty certain it's Hebrew.
You think? Yes. I wonder what they're singing in Hebrew.
Much the same, I'd imagine.
Oh. Maybe it's completely different. That would be a...
I suppose that would be one way of doing it, would be do the bit that's in Hebrew, going, ah, oh, we're great.
And the rest of it going. I think they stand a very good chance. They've got a medley of styles running throughout. They've got hilarious lyrics, because politics is funny when all is said and done.
I suppose the idea as well that the Eurovision Song Contest shouldn't be political is a little naive, given the vast amounts of politics involved in almost every aspect of it, the voting being the obvious example.
I think it's false to say it's not political. Anyway, it's always political. As Robin Carmody teaches us.
Yes. Quite hello, Robin. But certainly in terms of... I think it's the wrong kind of politics. So they're saying, ooh... They've been quite specific in saying, well, that George Bush, he's not very nice. Whereas the traditional Eurovision politics is... lovely world, wouldn't it be nice if everybody's lovely?
And expressed by the medium of dance as well.
Often, yes. Or sometimes the medium of balalaika.
Yes. All of which is good.
I think it's a failing in recent English entries, or UK entries, apologies, that the lack of politics and the fact we don't take it seriously enough is our failing.
I think Daz was political. Life, that's what the teachers say.
Maybe. But I think we need to be forced to take this thing more seriously. So my own feeling is that failing to win Eurovision should in future be considered an act of treason.
That's good. But who do we have in the running for us this year?
Well, that's a very good question, Sarah. I'm glad you asked.
Since the execution of DJ Daz earlier this week.
It's an interesting lineup this year. The choice we, the great British public, have to make, I believe it's on Saturday the 17th, is between Big Brothers, former hit makers Big Brothers. Brian Harvey, former hit maker Brian Harvey from the East 17s.
Is he the one who was famously caught out in an incident?
He's the one who ran over himself twice.
Allegedly.
By his own car. He's not been well, bless him. He's the shorter one.
Okay.
Then we have Liz McLarnon, former hitmaker Liz McLarnon from... she was at one point an Atomic Kitten. I'm not sure which version of Atomic Kitten that was. Then we have Hawkins and Brown, featuring former hitmaker Justin Hawkins from Them the Darknesses.
Crumbs.
And some woman. I believe she's called Beverly Brown, but okay. And then we have Scooch, former almost hitmaker Scooch. Kind of bad steps, basically.
And
finally, we have Cindy, who, to the best of my that's Cyndi.
Of course it is.
To the best of my knowledge, not in any way a hit maker.
The Dark Horse.
Possibly, yes, the Dark Horse. She has got a record contract. I haven't heard it, but I understand it sounds very much like the Malta entry from a couple of years ago by Ciara, or Ciara, or however we're pronouncing that. Not the R&B woman, the other one.
Ford Sierra.
Yes.
Not her.
No.
Nobody remembers it apart from you, Steve.
I read it on the internet. But also it sounds a bit Celine Dion, so it's your big everything out Euro ballad. So we'll see how we get on with that in the next couple of weeks. But yes, it's a bit of a shame, I think, that we're kind of tied down to people who've already been hit makers. I suppose this does kind of follow on. I mean, this is what happens in Sweden and places, isn't it? That when they have the Melodic Festival...
Oh, yes.
that they have all sorts of people coming in and...
Oh, that's true, but it does lead to the sad instance where there seems to be a bit of an odd thing, certainly with the Scandinavian countries, from what I've seen, that there's either a blend of people who have been steadily going along on the folk circuit for a while, they've got their fans who turn up, stick their finger in the air and go, ooh, yes, with your acoustical guitar ways, this is lovely, why don't you go and sing a lovely folk song at Eurovision? So you've got that strand, and then you've got the people who've been plugging the same old miming to backing tapes in the dodgy bars of... Not Helsinki. Sure. Nothing bad would happen in Helsinki. But,
isn't a Scandinavian miming to tapes festival? Because certainly there should be.
I'm afraid I can't answer that question just right now, Mark. Maybe we can look that up later.
Look that up.
Sorry, make that up.
Yeah, but the acoustical guitar stars seem to be completely ruined afterwards because the only way they can actually lose even more credibility from sticking finger in the ear and singing songs about pigs is to go on Eurovision. So it can ruin them, or it can build up the people who've been on the iffy club circuit. Now, I think that we haven't had enough folk stars coming in.
You can't have too much folk.
You can't? Well, I think you probably can.
I'm all about the folk.
I think we'll be testing that theory out later.
Good.
By hitting you with acoustical guitars until you stop. Well, you have got a beard today.
I have got a beard today. I am quite beardy. If only I had my Fair Isle jumper with me, then we'd be all about...
I can knit you one.
That's a good idea. Why don't we do
it
that?
It sure is.
Well, I think that's enough about Eurovision for one day. Rob's the first of us with a record to play for us this afternoon. What have we got, Rob?
We have The Magnetic Fields and The Death of Ferdinand de Saussure.
A pretty girl in her underwear.
Actually, that wasn't the song we thought it was. Sorry about that, magnetic field fans everywhere.
All so that, sounds the same
to me.
It was
still the magnetic field song.
It was still the magnetic field song. So that was, in fact, Underwear, and not... Sorry, what was it meant to be?
It was meant to be The Death of Ferdinand de Saussure.
And why were you going to play that one for us, Rob?
Well, in the song The Death of Ferdinand de Saussure, an act of violence occurs... Or a moment of anger leads to an act of particularly unproductive violence, in this case, the death of a linguist.
Struck down in his prime.
I'm stopping myself from making the obvious comment.
Indeed. But what I wanted to talk about is ways of turning our pent-up anger, our frustrations, into a more productive form of violence. And there is a particularly productive form of violence that most of us perform every day, which is the act of cooking.
Mm. I thought you were going to say something else.
Well,
something
I'm sure
not radio friendly at all.
I'm sure that you do something slightly more violent every day.
She's talking about knitting.
Of course, yes.
It has pointy things and.
Sorry. Carry on, Rob.
So, cookery, I believe, is something that is fundamentally violent. We go into our kitchens and we have at our disposal an array of weapons.
Yeah.
there's a video installation created by an American artist, Martha Rosler, called The Semiotics of the Kitchen.
Yes.
In which it's basically a parody of a cookery or housekeeping show, in which the artist appears as sort of typical American housewife apron and begins going through an alphabetical list of kitchen equipment. And in doing so, she will hold up the piece of equipment, say, wooden spoon, and then demonstrate its use, but do so in a very kind of violent and aggressive way.
This sounds great.
Yes, so she will say, "Oh, carving knife," and then make a stabbing motion with it.
Excellent.
What other equipment does she does? Because apart from carving knives, what are the other violent things?
Rolling pins, frying pans,
woks.
Woks do a lot of damage with a wok.
A wok can keep you safe though if you put it on your head and.
That's true.
If somebody's having a go at you with a wooden spoon, you're in the kitchen and you need to find something defensive. Well, I think a wok is the first thing I'd go for.
Providing it's not full of hot oil.
Oh, yeah. Well.
heavy cast iron frying pans. That's the
yes.
That's the best.
As Reeves and Mortimer taught us.
Exactly. And they do make that clang sound. Which again continues the point that practically anything in the kitchen is useful as a weapon, and the language of cooking itself is also very aggressive. We whip things, we beat things. but what this all leads on to is the fact that particularly aggressive acts of cooking are good for us.
Because they allow us to release this...
They allow us to release this, yeah, all these frustration and tensions. What I've done, in fact, is brought in a demonstration.
Excellent. Yay. We love live demonstration-type things
yes,
on the radio.
Yes, and, you know, this is the kind
what
of thing
that...
That obviously will work on the radio.
Good. Well, considering some of the things we've done over the past few weeks, I don't think we've got a problem there.
So...
And I think you wouldn't allow me to knit on the radio. Shocking.
Well, we did do the aromatherapy oils a few weeks ago. I think that was the height of smelling on the radio.
Yes.
So. What have you got for us, Rob? What have you got?
Well, okay, moving into Saturday kitchen mode. What I have is a bag.
We can hear the bag there.
And this bag contains a box of digestive biscuits. Now, what I require is a volunteer.
I'll be your volunteer. Unless Sarah, do you
Darn
really
it.
Want to be there? See,
no,
you've got to talk. You can't put your hand up on the radio. You've got to talk.
who has the most tension and frustration to release at the moment?
Me, I'll do it. I'm feeling a bit nervous today, so...
Yeah,
I...
okay. So, you'll probably want to keep things in the bag.
Oh, okay, right, yes, of course.
Sealed up and, you know, don't want to ruin nice
I should inform our listeners that Rob is reaching down at the moment
yes,
to
sorry,
something that looks particularly dangerous.
Yes.
How did he smuggle yes. that in here?
Excellent.
Now, this is...
a cudgel.
This short, stout piece of wood that I'm holding and have carried around London all morning.
Steady. Stop gesturing.
it is, in fact, a rolling pin.
Excellent.
They have handles.
And I'm going to hand it to Steve now.
Oh, this is nice.
And Steve is going to demonstrate its use... upon the biscuits, and give it his all.
For those of you watching in black and white, I'm adopting the, what was this called in?
The umbrella.
The umbrella, if one is used to WarioWare type movements. Here we go, then.
Ooh. That certainly looks that as
well.
That's better.
if everyone's speakers are still intact.
And there we have...
How are the biscuits looking?
They're not too bad. There's still some quite big bits.
Okay.
They haven't been touched at all.
Yes, they have. Don't believe him, listeners.
Steve breaks biscuits like a girl.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, if you take them out of the tub...
It's because I'd normally whack them myself. Well, it's the plastic. They're in a small plastic container, you see, listeners. So it's very difficult to get enough purchase on them.
That's true. And that, I've got to say, it's the first time I've seen a rolling pin without handles on the side. I mean, that just looks like a big sausage made out of
Oh, good morning and welcome to Innuendo FM.
So,
that's all right.
Lovely. Thank you, Rob.
So,
I feel much more relaxed now.
That's good. But then you now have your broken biscuits, which are now an ingredient, and... what you can then create using a fair amount of chocolate, a modicum of butter, and some golden syrup.
Hooray, we have cake!
Are the lovely cakes that I've just created.
Excellent.
Simply by mixing all the ingredients together and sticking it all in the fridge.
Oh, the fridge is certainly a good cooking method.
And very nice at taste, too. Caked all around, everybody.
I'll have one in a minute.
Okay, would you like one more?
No, I'll get it in the machine.
Yes, don't get in the machinery.
Cake in the machine.
I think the clear question that we're skirting around here, though, Rob, is given this kind of, you know, how important it is that that violence is part of cookery, can you in fact make an omelette without breaking any eggs?
Well, I would say it's... I don't believe that's possible. However, I don't think that it has ever been tested
scientifically
under proper empirical.
Well, there's only one thing to do then, and that's put it on the list for next Food Science Day.
And I suppose it would be more like a stacking your fried eggs and it combining.
Depends. It seems to me it does rather depend on the exact definition of the word omelet.
It does rather, doesn't it? Yes, obviously, and maybe there is. One of our vegan listeners could tell us whether there's some form of
egg replacement,
egg substitute from which one can make something.
About powdered egg?
Powdered egg probably still involves breaking
that's,
an egg.
How would you break it? No, if you take it,
it might be grated.
Not in a grated egg. Yeah. A grated hard-boiled egg.
No, it's a grated unboiled egg.
Yes.
You do it really, really quick.
You're trying too hard, I think. I'd argue.
That's a good point. Oh, well. But can you make an omelette in a microwave? I don't have one, so I'm a bit nervous about them.
You can make scrambled eggs quite easily.
It's true.
That tends to be the egg product that is formed.
And could you not make the omelette still inside the shell in a microwave?
You would
agitate the fresh egg.
Yes.
And to such a point that
when yolk and white
merge properly.
The point is, when you put it in the microwave, it would explode. Because that's what happens when you put eggs in microwaves.
Yeah, going back to violence and cookery.
If you made a tiny little breach in the shell, so that the pressure could be equalised, then...
With a pin,
obviously this is stretching the limits of breaking, because, I mean, there would be some who would argue that making a hole in the shell is breaking, but I think breaking is a more...
It's more of a surgical approach. Yes. Yes.
Maybe. Exactly. If you put it in one of those things that they shake paint up in paint shops, because they go up and down very quickly, that would be enough.
Enough to actually omeletify.
That's the word.
Yeah.
The only problem is that it'd be very difficult to season.
Yeah, and there's nothing worse than an unseasoned omelette.
Exactly.
You would just
inject it.
I mean, clearly, in order to test it,
you can't inject salt and pepper.
In order to test it, you would have to swallow the unbroken egg whole. But you could at least, you know, have the salt and pepper on the outside of it as you bolted it down. This is going to be the best Food Science Day ever.
Isn't it?
We should have the ambulance on hand.
Yes.
Paging St. John's.
So, thank you for that, everybody. Good. That's eggs sorted out, then.
Yeah, I'm confused.
Now we turn our attention to our good friend Tanya Hedden, and who will she be being very rude about today? And I think it is Marquis Smith and his The Falls.
Smith. He has a few issues, oh yes indeed. You see, he's concerned about the number of lesser bands out there who stole all their ideas from The Fall. I invented Acid House, me. I've been using dance techniques for years. Next he'll be telling us that The Fall invented jungle, given that for all this time they've had a drum and a bass in their band. Mark, I'm sorry, but use your ears, man. With the sad exception of Pavement, no fucker has ever ripped off The Fall. When Coldplay, for example, were sitting around deciding how they could best make a pile of dosh out of the gullible indie public, their deliberations ran in part as follows. We need to find a hugely popular group to copy. One who've redefined rock without losing their commercial appeal. One who combine excitingly progressive instrumentation with lyrical acuity, range and depth. Hey, I know, how about The Fall? You're fired. Further proof is perhaps needed. Find yourself a copy of the current national and indie top 40 charts. Now cast an eye down them, and we can accurately measure the number of groups who sound like The Fall. Let's see, shall we? Number of incomprehensible songs about goblins and Nazis? None. Number of ham-fisted rockabilly thrashes with two-note keyboard lines? None. Number of male singers with off-putting gimmick? Many. But none whose gimmick is quite as irritating as Smith's probably trademarked R sound. Yeah, very idiosyncratic. Number of groups who've made the same record for 20-plus years, use of trendy rhythms notwithstanding? One. But the Rolling Stones started that before The Fall did. Number of scathing attacks on current musical styles? God knows. Again, though, hardly a trend kicked off by Smith's mob. Incidentally, can anyone have really been surprised when Marquee Smith came out against glam? Let's face it, in 20 years of trying, The Fall have influenced one smug mob of check shirt musical panhandlers, plus the Creepers and the Blue Orchids, both of which were in any case started by individuals too shit for The Fall, a concept more terrifying than any contemporary horror Smith could come up with. That tradition could continue if The Fall lineup, binned by Smith last year, forms their own band. Tidings which would surely gladden the hearts of those millions of fans just desperate to hear a full instrumental record. I'm Tanya Heeden, and I hate music.
Thank you for that, Tanya. I'm sure that if Stuart Lee, honorary patron of Resonance FM, was listening, he will have enjoyed that greatly. So now we move onwards to Sarah.
Hello, everybody.
Hello, Sarah.
I'm going to talk about something that, in fact, I was talking to Tanya about at last Friday's Poptimism.
What were you talking to Tanya about?
Well, we were sitting in the corner scowling at all music like we do, and then somebody happened to play a track by the Sister Sisters. Oh, no, we thought, we don't like the Sister Sisters at all. And we thought...
Tanya hates all music.
Yeah, that's true. I just hate the Sister Sisters. I hate their awful, awful, awful faces and their awful sounds and everything about them. But when we got to thinking, what would be the best way of getting rid of that awful Jake Shears man? We thought a normal murderizing probably wouldn't be good enough. We'd have to look for some sort of special way that we'd get the maximum enjoyment out of the expiration of this dreadful, dreadful individual. So we started thinking about the most unusual murderizings that have happened in the past, and what we could apply to Jake. Of course, all Jakes in pop should be murderised, we came up with, but we could only think of a Jake Shillingford out of the My Life Stories, because Jake's not a very rock and roll name, is it?
And he wasn't really very in pop either, was he, Jake?
Jake the Peg!
Diddle-diddle-um.
Where was he in the charts?
I imagine
he's
it was
never been out of the charts, in my heart.
That's true. Well, we can destroy him anyway. I mean, that's fine. But as we drifted off into a lovely reverie where all the music just subsided to a rumble, we started thinking about historical unusual murderizings. The oldest one we could find was when some Vikings used to have at each other. You'd think this would usually be with axes and so on, pillaging and
yes,
various things. But it turns out that the Vikings were actually big wets. Vikings, apparently, this is according to Guy of Warwick in the 1450s.
Well, that's quite late.
That's
yes.
He's a long time
Well,
afterwards.
That's when he wrote about the Vikings.
I know, I think he might
Vikings
have been.
Vikings weren't alive then, Steve.
No, I think he might have been.
Do you know nothing?
Is Guy of Warwick a friend of Bloke from Lest?
Yes. Yes, he was. What's that noise?
It's
Who
a
knows?
Noise. Carry on.
But anyway, the Vikings were so wet that not only did they have silly murderizing methods, but they also wrote poetry about it. The Vikings would often have a go at each other over games of chess. And I've got a poem for you, which I will read in the authentic oldie English style.
Excellent.
Yep, it's good. The situation here is that two lords are having a little game of chess. One is called Faber and the other one is called Sodan. In Viking or Old Norse, it's probably pronounced differently, but you'll just have to live with it. Here, let the poem commence. Faber, quoth Sodan, it pity thee to play at the chesses with me. Sir, quoth he, with mine entente I shall do your commandment. They sat down friendies in all ways, but hey were they wroth ere did they rise. So they start playing some chess.
And then they get a bit angry.
They do. One of the Vikings has an insult that I probably can't say on Resonance 104.4 FM, despite what Tanya has said. naughty, naughty Tanya. So they have a big fight, and the poem continues to show you what happened. On his fate did he stand. He took the checker in his hand. He smote Swoden under the ear. He fell to grounder and died there.
Wait, were they playing chess or checkers?
Chess. A checker is actually the old term for a chessboard. But what you've got to understand when they were playing chess in these days is that they didn't make it out of cardboard. Their chess sets were huge, giant, paving slab-esque rock behemoths.
Like in The Prisoner.
Sorry?
Like in The Prisoner.
Probably like in The Prisoner, yeah. So one whack with those and you'd be dead. And then, of course, they moved on to playing solitaire, and we all know that's a game for one only. It's a bit difficult when the cards are actually made out of paving slabs,
yes.
Like they were. But that changed. But at least you know that you can actually get rid of somebody that way. If we move on to the modern times, people seem to become less and less breakable as time goes on, as humans become more resilient. There's a good story about the Murder Trust in 1933, who decided that they'd off this chap in order to get his life insurance. He was insured for the massive sum of $3,500.
I say.
Yeah, which, as we all know, in today's money is worth about 10p.
Yes.
Very, very foolish. I'll proceed to list a number of things that they did, which failed to do this guy in. This guy was called Michael Malloy, and he was an alcoholic homeless in the New Yorks.
Right.
Yes. So they thought... Well, sorry, Mark.
I was interested that an alcoholic homeless in the New Yorks would have his life insured.
They took out the policies.
So it was fraud as well as murderising.
I think the murderising is probably more
that trumps
important.
Fraud in yeah. most... Even in New York.
Okay.
Yeah, it does take precedent. So they thought that, okay, well, the obvious way to kill him, because it had to be accidental death. Of course.
Of course.
Yes. Mm. So one of these guys had a bar. He thought, unlimited booze has got to kill this man. So in comes Michael, drinks them dry, day after day after day. Nah, he's still alive, that's not doing the business. So they decide to up this a bit. They decide to mix the booze with antifreeze. I should again repeat that this is unlimited antifreeze. Next week, he's still coming in drinking his antifreeze.
But this is...
Then,
this is in the days before antifreeze, because I mean everyone knows that winters and snow and ice were much more extreme and potent in the past, and antifreeze was clearly just much less strong.
Well, that doesn't make sense, surely.
Sure it does.
No. Surely, if it was colder, then they'd need stronger antifreeze.
They'd need it, but they didn't have it.
How do you know? Were you
okay.
there? Are you one of them?
He was, yes.
Of course I was.
Anyway,
you know
surely you can't object about turpentine, whatever that is.
Turpentine.
I don't really know what that
it's
is.
Paint
I know
stripper.
The wind. Oh, yeah, paint stripper. Then horse liniment the next week. Maybe the next month. I am not quite sure of the timescale of this. Rat poison failed to off him. And then they thought, obviously liquid can't do the job with this unbreakable man. So they decided to have a special offer in their bar. Oh, you're just on bar snacks. And these snacks happen to be raw oysters marinated in rubbing alcohol.
Mmm.
Yum, yum, yum. Guess what?
I'm assuming he didn't die.
He didn't die! So then they decided to... Well, right, we'll carry on with the
Surely
snacks.
Surely they've spent $3,500 by this
point. Yes, on
the oysters
alone.
Antifreeze was cheap in those days. But then they decided they'd make him a sardine sandwich. But what else was in this sardine sandwich? It was carpet tacks and metal shavings.
Not yum yum.
Not them.
Yeah, but, well, that was the worst one of all. Obviously, that's not going to kill somebody. I have two of those every day. Finally, they decided, sod this, it's not working. Buried him in snow, poured lots of ice water on him, left him to freeze to death. The next day, he turns up at the bar. Where's my horse, sir? My horse poison, or whatever it was.
I mean, you know why, obviously... putting him under the snow and the ice is clearly not going to work.
Because he's full of antifreeze.
I really feel these people hadn't thought through.
No. Surely, if they're giving him sandwiches full of carpet tacks, there's no way that's going to ever be recorded as accidental death.
Yeah, no, if you're an alcoholic.
They've pretty much given up by this point. Their next attempts are hitting him with a taxi, which one of them steals. This actually sends him to hospital. He's in there for 3 weeks. After 3 weeks, he comes back to the bar. And they give up at that point. They finally off him by waiting till he's passed out, getting a hose for him attached to the gas main, sticking it in his mouth, and eventually he corks it. And then the recorder...
He corks it? That's very ambiguous.
Cork it! Cork it. Yeah, I wonder where I got that one from. That's not right. Verdict, death by pneumonia.
Dope.
Yeah. However, no, that's okay. They would have got away with it, except that they were so frustrated and mad about this awful, unbreakable man that they told pretty much everybody in New York City what they were doing.
That was only 14 people at the time.
Yeah, that's true. And then the police heard about it, arrested the lot, electric chair. I wouldn't be impressed.
No.
No, not at all.
I think this goes to show that crime does not pay, listeners.
Well, certainly not $3,500.
But the irony is that... at that date, the electric chair wasn't counted as a method of murder and was in fact considered accidental. So they got the money after all?
No. They went to the electric chair.
Yes, but they'd all insured each other as well, obviously.
That's a good idea. My final fact about Michael Malloy is that that's the title of a song by a band called Gob on a split single with Agoraphobic Nosebleed, which I think were probably the band on before the Freaky Trigger and the Lolcats of Pop started.
I think it was, wasn't it? Yes, they certainly sounded slightly nosebleedy. Have you got a song for us, Sarah?
Have I got a song for you?
Yes, you've got the Free Design song.
Oh, so I do.
Well done.
The Free Design are not murderisers, I should say. They're all good Catholics.
And I hope this is the Free Design.
Is it track 5?
It is indeed track 5.
We'll be all right then.
If it's not the wrong CD.
Agoraphobic Nosebleed!
Abandon and go to the bank with your money. It's a hit. Should it be a hit?
Yeah.
Gonna make a hit.
You take a little drops,
add a little bass, and let the guitar play.
And that was Free Design there with 2002, a hit song, which wasn't a hit song, as kind of happens in the song itself.
It's the ironing is staggering.
The ironing is, after all, staggering. And now we're going to hear from our good friend Dr. Pub. He's got another question for us this week, and let's see what he's got to say.
Hello. I'm Dr. Pub, inventor of the bottomless pint glass, something that would revolutionise English drinking if it wasn't for the fact that beer and cider was regularly sloshed on the floor of the standard English circuit pub on a Friday night. Anyway, this week's question comes from Marnie, who asks, and I read, "Dear Dr. Pub, I like to go for a drink with my friends, but there's quite a lot of them. And unfortunately, I have a terrible memory. I am afraid that when they ask me to get a large round in, I'll forget which drink is which. Please, Dr. Pub, how do you remember very large rounds?" Well, Marnie, it's a very good question, and one which our goldfish memory lolos, I'm sure, sympathise with. Indeed, I best ask them the question soon, or they'll forget what it was. So, lolos, over to you.
Thank you, Dr. Pub there. So, rounds then, Rob. You to start off, how do you remember a round?
Well, I think the best way to do it is to make up a handy mnemonic upon getting the order. So if somebody, say, ordered 2 Guinnesses, a lager and a martini, which nobody would ever do, but
yes.
You could say, "Oh, good gracious, loud music."
Very good. That's look at that. Speed of the brain there. You can hear, that's what the whirring noise is, in fact. It's the sound of Rob's brain.
Oh, mind cogs.
Mind cogs. Mark, how about you? How do you remember a round?
Well, my method is to split the round with people with good memories. And as the evening progresses and memories get poorer, I split the round in a larger and larger amounts until eventually everyone is remembering and buying their own drink.
Ah. That's an interesting and unusual method, Mark, which seems to step away from the, perhaps some might say, the concept of the round a little. Sarah, your contribution to this stunning debate.
Yeah, my contribution is that people who are lucky enough to have me buying them drinks will drink what they're flipping well given, and they'll enjoy it, especially if it's martini, 2 lagers and a Guinness, all in the same glass. Which it will be.
Marvellous there.
Cocktail got a name?
Is that, I very much doubt that. I imagine it would be called an bleh.
Listeners could text in with a name for this exciting cocktail.
I think it should be called The Round.
The Round, of course.
Ladies and gentlemen, The Round's on me.
Well, that's that's what we've got to say. Let's hear what Dr. Pub has to say.
Well, I'm sure you'll agree. Fascinating dimwittery there from our lollards. But this is a serious question, and one which needs a serious answer. Rounds are what marks out the British drinker in the world. Being able to excel at rounds means one excels at life. And excelling at life means having a good memory. Now, as any quack doctor from a Sunday supplement will tell you, good memory is all about association. I say, associate the person with their drink. Indeed, not just associate, visualise. So instead of going down the pub with your friend Steve, why not go down the pub with your friend Steve the Pint of Guinness? Suddenly it's a lot easier. Why, Ralph, he regularly drinks gin and tonics. Well, I couldn't see him in the street without a lemon poking out of his head. You'll soon find that it's very easy to remember what people drink. Short people often drink halves, after all. So don't go down the pub with Tom, Emma and Tim. Go to the pub with Cronenberg, small glass of white wine and a pint of ordinary, please. I'm Dr. Pub, but you can call me Dr. Aspel Suffolk Cider. Happy drinking.
Thank you very much there, Dr. Pub. As always, a very sensible and cider-based answer. Mark, it's your turn now. What are we going to hear about today?
Well, I was interested, given that one of the earlier songs was about hits, and it's in a sense all of them have been, mysteriously
yes.
enough. Well, except the wrong Magnetic Field song, which was in fact about underpants. I was interested in the shape of popular music before charts.
It was a triangle.
Established. It was indeed a triangle, and I shall prove that later. The first chart is routinely regarded as a proper chart was the Lucky Strike Hit Parade, which was a radio show in the mid-30s. And to give a sense of the effect that recording had had on the music that was prior to that, I'm going to read the introduction to what constituted a chart before that, which is, as you can see, as listeners can see, a big book.
It's a big red book.
And it's called The News Chronicle, Music for the Home. Favourite songs, favourite waltzes, renowned pianoforte pieces, arias from Grand Opera, Cries of London, Grand Marches. Edited by Sir Landon Ronald, who, as a nice picture demonstrates, is an ancestor of the Crazy Frog. He says this. Statistics prove that the sale of music of every kind and description, excepting perhaps dance music, is so seriously on the wane that publishers are inclined to fight shy of bringing out new songs or pianoforte pieces when they know that there will be scarcely any sale for them. What has brought about this state of affairs? I fear there is but one answer. The habit of listening to music instead of performing it. This is so deeply to be deplored and is so damaging to the progress and development of a beautiful art that it is up to all music lovers to do what they can to prevent it from spreading. Chiefly, with the idea of encouraging the public to revert to the habit of making music for themselves in the home, the News Chronicle has issued this book, which is comprised of popular and famous musical numbers. All tastes have been provided for. You will find the art song, the popular ballad, the classical pianoforte ballad, just a ballad. It's not that many texts.
No.
The classical pianoforte piece, some waltzes and marches, as well as operatic arias.
Yeah, have you got any R&B, mate?
There are not any numbers which you need to be ashamed to play or sing yourself, because they are all good of their kind.
Now, you see, obviously, if we'd put a bit of thought into this, we could have had The Wizard by Paul Simon. Paul Hardcastle. The music that they used on the countdown on the charts in the mid-80s under that as a bed, but never mind.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I could have held the book and
played a bed at the same time.
It sounds easier than it actually is.
It must have been very expensive to produce one of those books every Sunday as well.
Yes.
Landon Ronald is interesting because he was actually the MC of the first big attempt by a record company, which was called the Gramophone and Typewriter Company, to appeal to a kind of highbrow audience. He was in about 1905 or something like that. He was the MC of the Red Seal label, which was the first time to actually niche marketing of music. Prior to that, when Cylinders were at war with the first discs, the music had basically been whoever walked into the studio, which was
pretty like Lollards.
It was a bit. It was very Lollardy, and it would be not very far from any old drunk coming into the studio and
<Hi there. laughs>
and doing their party piece. The point at which this turned round, the people who actually invented records, flat records, as opposed to cylinders, realised that it would be quite a coup to get someone who was famous in their own right instead of just stumbling along the high street.
And who might those famous people have included, Mark?
Well, the first person to have a million-selling record was Enrico Caruso.
The Great Caruso.
The Great Caruso. And as he was already known as the Great Caruso, obviously he decided to go on stage to make use of his nickname.
That was handy, wasn't it?
Was in fact already in the news a lot by the time people from the Gramophone Company turned up at his door and said, "Why don't you record something?" And because he was a man who liked a prank,
a prank.
He thought this was a good idea. Yes, he's one of his more famous on-stage stunts was while Dame Nellie Melba, named after the ice cream,
yes,
was singing "My Tiny Hand Is Frozen," because obviously the ice cream.
She was holding the ice cream.
She was singing "My Tiny Hand Is Frozen," and he put a hot Italian sausage in her hand.
I heard this story the other night, listeners, and had forgotten it until that moment and realised what was coming up. And
So I think we should all calm ourselves down by hearing some of Caruso's greatness. It says sleep there, so I don't know if this will start.
I think it should do, yes.
Okay.
Si salterà, l'ora è bella per danzare, chi in amor non mancherà. Dalla luna in mezzo al mare, mamma mia, si salterà. L'ora è bella per danzare, chi in amor non mancherà. Fuggiò la luna in mezzo al mare, mamma mia, si salterà. Presto in fondo, 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 donne mie, venite qua. Un garzon belleggia quando a ciascuno toccherà. Finché in ciel bralluna stella e la luna splenderà. Bel con la più bella tutta notte danzerà. Mamma mia, cala luna in mezzo al mare. Mamma mia si salterà. Fring, 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 fring. Mamma mia si salterà. Fring, 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 fring. Mamma mia si salterà. La 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 la
The Great Caruso there.
At which the Philistines in the studio insisted we cut short for some reason.
He'd run out of words.
Yeah, he was just going la.
La 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 la.
That's how Italian is.
La, la, oh, I see. La. Okay. Mamma mia.
What else have you got to tell us, Mark?
Well, I think the thing that's interesting about that, that isn't in fact the first million-selling thing, because I had a bit of a grandad moment this week and didn't realise I would be able to find the song which did sell that many as a free MP3. I didn't realise that till this morning and didn't get sorted. That's a song from a Rossini operetta called La Danza. But the thing about it is, it seems to me, that it's actually a bit rubbish. He obviously has this fantastic voice. I mean, you can tell that he's totally on top of what he does. Mm-hmm. But the orchestra are kind of all over the place, and they're not really in tune. And I mean, I've heard worse than that. But this is from around 1915, where they were starting to get their chops together a bit and to appeal to the more discerning of their audience.
Because, well, I mean, obviously, there'd be issues around recording technology, but if that wouldn't necessarily mean the instrument should be out of tune.
I think it must have been difficult earlier on, especially in the cylinder days when they had brass bands and small orchestras, because they didn't have microphones. They played into a big horn, and if you were further away than somewhere else, then you didn't get help. So they had to stand in a way so that they were all equally far from the horn. And that was obviously probably a bit distracting to their... but also, as I say, they weren't necessarily the greatest technicians. The really good players, I think, with the exception of Caruso and a subsequent generation, were very sniffy about recording, and I think probably the best players just didn't go in because they thought it sounded awful, and they were worried that it showed up that they weren't necessarily as good as they thought they were.
And I suppose there's maybe as well the kind of demarcation issue, isn't there, where, you know, they're taking our jobs kind of thing, and if we make recordings, then people won't be going and listening to live music.
Well, no, I think at that stage, I think the disparity between the quality was so huge that I don't think that came to be an issue for many years, because it really was a tinny little object, and it was considered too laughable by serious musicians rather than a threat. But the other thing that happened, which is what Landon Ronald is talking about, is that amateurs in the field of classical or serious music became very intimidated and simply dropped out of it, and people wouldn't even really play from books like this at home anymore because you could hear the professionals doing it, and there was you know, an increase in the quality of performance on records, really marked increase, and that people who were just kind of okay got played less and less. Or, in fact, what they actually did was they went into other forms of music, and the cult of the amateur is another name for rock music.
Or indeed, back to folk music. It's all about the folk, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, I hate the folk. Why was Caruso so this famous dude? You've already said that he had the habit of slipping sausages into ladies' tiny, tiny frozen hands. But you said that he was in the news already. Was he in the news because of his or was he in the news because of a bockwurst-related activities on a major scale?
I think it was both. I think he was fun to write about, and he was at a particular age. He was in his late 20s when he became a big star, and I think he was very good copy at a time when newspapers were enjoying the fact that they could cover international things, and so he'd played all over the world by the time he was 29 in the previous 2 or 3 years.
Was he ginger?
I think he was somewhat bald.
Oh.
He looked a bit like Poirot.
Yay!
Excellent.
We love the Christy here.
Would you put sunglasses on and off, sort of, during performances?
No. Yeah.
Oh, sorry, I see where we're going with the Caruso thing now. Oh, dear. No, it's not David Caruso.
I did it last time, I'll do it again.
Thank you. And I think on that note, it's time to go to the number one from this week's illegal download chart. And it's DJ Format with The Hit Song.
Than a king of the seven, I'm feeling lucky, so I was like, hit me. At which point my phone rang and it hit me. Did I mention the format? He should hit me. Off on the cell, he put my cards down and hit the talk button.
Andy, it's Matt. Let me ask you something, mate. I've just come from London, you know, we're meeting with the label. They seem to want another hit. Are you available?
I was like, dude, you know what to do. Peruse through a few new beats and promptly hit me. Off with a beat tape, a bloody edit disc, so when I'm writing, I can swiftly rewind the hitting drums. Couple of weeks of hits, I'll have written some, and I'll be kicking them just as soon as I can hit England. I hope that my plane won't be swinging from hitting turbulence, or else I'll be hit with disturbances. Down in my gut, you know, nervousness.
Sorry about that. You've been listening to Sarah Clark, Rob Brennan and Mark Sinker, who's also been twiddling our knobs. What a clever chap he is. You can find us on the internet at freakytrigger.co.uk. Now it's time to leave Tim Pan Alley and pop round to the Pillars of Hercules for a reviving half. Stay tuned for The Other Woman, all-female playlist from Ruth Barnes, followed by Calling All Pensioners and the Rocket 88 Doo-Wop and Rock and Roll Show at 3. Today's show is brought to you by the word hit. I'm Uncle Carsmile. Thanks for listening.
Absent format, not doing what others did.
Step in the studio, it's just another hit.
All right, I want you to listen to this next little version. If you feel like it, sing along. And if you don't want to sing along, maybe you can clap your hands.
As I sit, infinite scripts I can listen from the tip of the big clutch betwixt my digits lit. Strictly from the itty bit of sunlight that managed to slip through the curtain's thin slits. It's illumination adequate to the point that I can refrain from hitting electric switches, which is a good thing because it prevents my hydro bill from hitching up to fever pitches. I'll be dimly lit, my raps exhibit wit, which would even shine through an Egyptian crib. Till equipped lyricists that stupidly step to this, surrender for fish shit. Nitwit quits with pits in verses. Versus the verses that this kid spits. Insist to persist, you'll cease to exist. So cease and desist. Don't meet with my fist, specifically your lips. Cause that's the gist where they can list after hits. Where they can list after hits. I use the word hit in many sentences. Listen how many hits I managed to condense in the first verse. In the second, I'm trying to rhyme as many words I can find it sound like it in the last. First, related metaphors, example, I write more hits than mask, I hit sample. Absent format, musical brothers, kid.
Step in the studio, it's just another
hit. See, I got hits, kid, so many hits.
How many hits you got?
Lots. Exemplary metaphors, let me select a few. More hits than when you're playing blackjack with a deck of twos. More hits than Latin percussionists administer the woodblocks. More hits.